From the independent producer project of KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters. Just a quick note, the names in the story have been changed.
In the moment that I decided to go to Myanmar, I was traveling in Thailand, and I was beginning to feel a little disgusted with myself. Tourism there was so prevalent that the whole experience was run like a depressingly efficient machine. For weeks, I'd been herded onto boats and buses with crowds of other backpackers in their generic uniforms of elephant pants and fluorescent crop tops. I was beginning to feel like we had all come to Asia just to hang out with each other. It was spring of 2014, just 2 years after Myanmar emerged from decades of political isolation imposed by a totalitarian military regime. Now the country was experimenting with democracy. And despite the skepticism of the U.S. government, it was now possible for me to get a tourist visa. But the U.S. Embassy's website still cautioned against recreational travel to Myanmar's more remote regions, basically saying, travel at your own risk. The embassy can't guarantee help if you get into trouble. Please, be careful. I take these embassy recommendations with a grain of salt. In fact, I tend to seek out countries with travel advisories, cities with bad reputations, neighborhoods without tourist attractions. It's sort of risky behavior, I know. I got robbed once, but that's the worst thing that's ever happened. Sometimes you get robbed, but then sometimes you have a brush with something complicated and honest. That's what I was looking for in Southeast Asia, but so far, for the most part, all I'd found was Red Bull and vodka on the beach. At the full moon party in Koh Phangan, a skinny drunk Frenchman punched me in the face. I returned to Bangkok the next morning and bought a ticket to Yangon, Myanmar.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
plunging something into the cutaway hillside.
The podcast about
the unknown.
As soon as I stepped off the plane in Yangon, I noticed that things were different. The men wore longis, which were long pieces of fabric tied around their waist like a skirt. And the women wore tanaka, a thick beige makeup made from tree bark, smeared across their cheeks or dotted in designs on their forehead and noses. The food was intensely flavorful, somewhere between Indian and Sichuan cuisine. When I went out to eat, I would just point at pots of simmering meats, and they were served to me with rice and small bowls of pickled things, fragrant condiments and unfamiliar fresh herbs. Vendors sold fried crickets on the street like bags of popcorn. Everywhere I went, people were friendly and curious. Those that spoke English were eager to practice, and strangers often approached me just to chat. Men smiled when they saw my tattoos and patted their own so I'd notice them, their traditional tattoos often done with sharpened bamboo. People were fascinated by my Western clothes and by how unusually tall I am, at 6 feet. Women in Myanmar rarely wear pants, don't smoke, don't have tattoos. I wasn't exactly a man, but I was closer to one than a typical woman. Electricity was unreliable, even in the former capital city of Yangon. It was May and it was hot. The monsoon was about to hit and it felt as though the atmosphere was going to burst at any minute. After Yangon, I took the archaic overnight train to Bagan, which rocked violently through the night. In Bagan, I spent days wandering around the deserted thousand-year-old temples. At Inlay Lake, I rolled cigars and watched fishermen paddle boats with their feet while they cast nets with their hands. In Mandalay, I rode motorbikes around a city with a population of 1.2 million people and almost no stoplights. My next destination was a city called Sipaw, in a region known as the Shan State. The Shan State encompasses a plateau, stretching from the center of the country eastward to the borders of China, Laos, and Thailand. Dozens of distinct cultures live here, villages with completely different religions, dress, and language, living within a few hours' walk of each other. The terrain is rough and generally inaccessible by vehicle. Myanmar used to be called Burma, and sometimes it still is. Hundreds of ethnic minorities live within its borders, but a single ethnic majority, the Burmese, have held almost all political power since the late 40s. Armed rebel groups, many from the Shan State, have been fighting for political representation for decades. The conflict that boils in these hills remains largely hidden, but it is part of one of the longest-running civil wars on the planet. I was more or less ignorant to the details of the ongoing conflict, but I did have a sense that I was getting close to something insidious. There were little hints, like the fact that all roads beyond Sipaw were closely monitored by the government. They were dotted with military checkpoints or required government escorts and special permits to pass through. There was something going on in these mountains that I wasn't supposed to see. To this day, I'm not sure if my trek into the jungle was technically legal or not, but I was excited and eager for an adventure. At the time, few travelers made it to Myanmar. Those of us who were there crossed paths often. In Sipaw, I ran into Marty, a guy I'd met briefly at a hostel in Mandalay a week earlier. Marty was a 20-year-old backpacker from Canada. He was taking a break from college to travel Southeast Asia and go surfing. He was skinny, tall, blonde, and sunburned, and I thought he seemed like the perfect travel companion. Down for anything, not too cautious. Neither of us had planned much beyond our arrival in Sipaw. As we sat in the courtyard, a group of backpackers arrived at the guest house with their guide, William. While his trekking group looked disheveled, dusty, and exhausted, William looked polished. He was handsome, with a square jaw made of lean muscle. He had a thick head of jet black hair and deep wrinkles from years of squinting in the sun. He told us he could take us into the mountains to see the villages. We negotiated with him and settled on 3 days and 2 nights. We would leave first thing the next morning. In the morning, we started walking. The paved street quickly turned to gravel and then dirt as we left the city limits. We passed clear-cut rolling farmland, many people working in the red dirt. Occasionally, we were forced off the path by lumbering trucks, improvised diesel mashups of antique farm equipment and water pumps. At other times, we gave wide berth to water buffalo wallowing in particularly muddy sections of trail. William called to the women working in the fields, got them to put down their seeds and tools and flirt with him instead. He tousled the hair of kids playing in the road as we passed, told them secret jokes, grinning at them mischievously while they giggled. He told us about the wild animals that lived here before the forest was clear-cut for farming. We slowly gained altitude, and what had started out as a muddy road turned into rutted-out clay paths, baked into a hardness like cement. The farmland grew steeper and steeper, until it turned into forest, and then thick jungle. William studied the trees while we walked and whistled to the birds, trying to get them to reply. Trucks no longer passed us. Instead, we passed slowly moving mule trains. The animals were skinny and loaded with supplies. Their human escorts jogged from the lead to the rear as they trudged along, shouting and chucking baseball-sized rocks at the non-compliant mules. As the day burned on into late afternoon, we gained a ridgeline, and I had my first clear view of the country. A breeze hit the sweat pouring down my face, and I took a moment to look out over the cascading mountains that stretched off and crowded out the horizon. The late afternoon sun cast dark shadows in the valleys thousands of feet below us. William pointed to a spot in the mountains where I thought maybe I could make out the glinting of metal roofs. He said that's where his home was, a town called Namshan. It was a few days walking from here, very far away. He told me his family lived there, his wife and his children. Then he pointed to a valley below us, not the first valley, but the second. He told me that there was fighting going on in that valley on Friday. He was guiding some French girls, and they were standing in this very spot, and they could hear the boom of RPGs. I was shocked. I asked, "But isn't that close?" He laughed at me as though I were being naive and said, no, it's very far, very far." I looked down and strained my eyes, peering into the dark valley. There was no clearing, no road, no charred foliage, just thick, silent jungle. As the sun set, we arrived at the village where we'd spend the night. It was situated at the top of a mountain ridge, with its houses and tea fields dropping away from the road and spilling down the steep, rippled mountainside. Our accommodation was the village general store that doubled as a guest house for travelers. The heavy wooden doors slid open during business hours to expose displays stocked with brightly colored packages of candy, snacks, and sugary powdered drinks. The guest house would have been spacious if it weren't for enormous canvas bags of dried tea leaves stacked to the ceiling. They were like sandbags, but five times the size, 50 pounds each. They stood like walls that had to be maneuvered around, only enough room for a person to sidestep between them. We sat down to dinner, and the guest house owner's wife served us a typical mountain meal. Stewed morning glory, fermented tea leaf salad with fried peanuts, omelet with onions, and broth with greens and bean sprouts. Marty and I complimented the guest house owner and his wife's cooking by gesticulating in an improvised sign language, rubbing our stomachs and exaggeratedly pointing at the food. A puddle of young girls peeked at us through the stacks of tea bags and giggled while we ate. They sat on the floor with their feet tucked beneath them, perched like birds. They all had long black hair tied back and traditional Tanaka makeup spread on their cheeks. At one point, they burst out laughing. The oldest girl, the tallest, not more than 14, stared straight at me, stone-faced with icy eyes. They stifled their giggles. One of them said something to William. He smiled and looked at me. "She says you look like a man." He laughed, and I laughed, but the girl held her stare until I finally looked away. William proudly announced that it was time for wine. All day, William had kept Marty and I motivated with promises of cherry wine. I imagined artisanal fermented fruit, hand-picked and crushed by the local villagers, fermenting in open buckets and broken out only for special guests and ceremonies. But as we relocated to the benches along the road in front of the guest house, what William proudly presented to us was two 12-ounce bottles of cheap wine coolers imported from Thailand. Their labels were dusty and peeling, but I recognized the metallic purple with gold script. For a split second, I thought he was joking. But then I noticed the pride with which he presented the bottle to us, as though it were a special vintage. So the three of us sat quietly, savoring our wine and looking up at the stars. I dragged on a squished Burmese cigarette from the package I'd crammed into my day bag. I felt good, exhausted, and content to be far away from the madness of Thailand. The feeling didn't last long. Shadows moved in my peripheral vision. But before I could make out the shapes, William turned to us and said sharply, "Take your things and go inside." I was startled by the urgency in his voice. Inside, the guest house owner and his wife tried to barricade us behind the stacks of tea, seating us in some wicker chairs in the rear of the store. I strummed my fingers nervously on the armrest. Marty asked me, "Did you see them?" I shook my head no. He said, "They're soldiers." They were gathered in front of the shop now, and we could hear them talking and shuffling on the cement floor a few feet away. I had heard Marty's words, but I hadn't really understood what Marty meant until one of the soldiers came around the stacked tea and inadvertently penetrated our makeshift fortress. He wore camouflage and a green army cap, a bandolier of long bullets strung across his chest like a sash, machine gun resting against his shoulder. He was thin but strong, with a square head, thick jaw, and a pockmarked face. I stared at him, amazed. He looked surprised for a moment, but then began looking around for somewhere to sit. He found a stool and sat down a few feet away, facing me and Marty in the cramped space between the tea stacks. Our knees almost touched. He set the butt of his M16 on the cement floor and leaned against it tiredly. Our eyes met, and we greeted one another in the Shan language.
Mai soon ka.
Mai soon ka.
I looked to William for some kind of clue as to what was going on. He was sitting nearby on the floor, but he had picked up a newspaper and was busying himself by reading it. I was concerned that he was now so checked out, like he was trying to play it cool. I tried not to look at it, but the machine gun pulsed and glowed red-hot below my gaze. I could feel anxiety beginning to close in on me in this conspicuous silence. I wondered if I'd look back on this moment as a pivotal one that split my life into two parts, if something was about to change irrevocably. I thought of the Americans hiking in Iraq a few years back, who had accidentally wandered into Iran and were held prisoner for like a year and a half. I hated that I hadn't seriously considered the risks that I was taking by coming here. I wished I could rewind to that moment when I looked at the embassy's website and read every word carefully this time, see what clues it was giving me. I wished I had paid attention. I imagined reaching out and grabbing the black barrel of the machine gun. It was less than an arm's length away. I could reach out and touch it. I could snatch it from under his elbow in a single motion. When I heard sounds of chairs scraping the cement, the shuffling and clanking of empty teacups, my heart leapt. It was the sound of people leaving. The soldier sitting with me stood, and I stood as well. He reached out and shook my hand in the most formal of all Myanmar greetings, a firm handshake with the right elbow supported by the left hand. Then he was gone. The girls on the floor burst out laughing again. I asked William what they were saying. He gestured toward the now departed soldiers and said, "They thought you were a man." I looked at the girls. The tall, serious one was sitting up unnaturally straight, pantomiming the way he had shaken my hand. The rest of the girls rolled on the floor, giggling. I tried to pretend that I thought it was funny. I asked William who they were. He said they were members of the Shan army coming back with a resupply from China. They were traveling in a truck full of new M16s and ammunition that they had smuggled across the Chinese border. They were avoiding the highways and instead rumbled along the rutted-out, hard-baked dirt paths that we had been walking on. They had been driving for days, sleeping in the bush. This was a pit stop. William walked me outside so he could show me the way to the outhouse. Walking along the dark road, he paused and seemed to scan the surrounding peaks. Finally, he said, "See, there they go. Don't worry, they're gone." He pointed across the valley, and I saw headlights making slow and bouncy progress, climbing back up the mountain on the other side. I asked if our hosts would be in trouble if the government knew that they had been here. I asked if we were in danger. He said, "No. These are our people. This has nothing to do with you." I asked again if the fighting was close, and he assured me that the fighting was very far away. That night, I dreamt of planes crashing. Every time, I was the only passenger who was concerned enough to pack a parachute, and because of that, I was the only one who survived. I woke up in the night to the heavy feeling of dread. Marty slept quietly on the mat next to me. He shared none of my anxieties. I wanted to believe William when he said everything was fine, but I knew that in the morning we would continue down the same road as that truck full of soldiers and ammunition, and it just felt like a bad idea. When we got up the next morning, the mountain air was clear and cool, and for a little while it seemed like the soldiers might have just been another bad dream. The three of us walked along the road, following it out of town and down into the next valley. We were so deep in the country now that I could no longer orient myself in relation to the direction of Sipaw. But I had relaxed into the rhythm of walking and was happily daydreaming when the topic of conversation between William and Marty inexplicably turned to landmines. I interrupted. I asked, "Does the Shan army use landmines?" And William said, "Yes, remote mines, that they stick them into the road, like this," and he mimed plunging something into the cutaway hillside. He explained, "Then they watch with binoculars and set them off when the Burmese trucks pass, sometimes many in a cluster, killing many people, a leg here, an arm there." He said this with a childish giggle. My heart sank. I asked, "But they're far away, right?" "Oh, yes, very far." When I heard thunder in the distance, I thought it was the booming of artillery shells. I mistook the groaning of a bamboo forest for shouts from the hilltops. We arrived at a village and had lunch in a dark guest house. I smoked cigarettes and glanced frequently out the glassless windows, keeping watch for soldiers. The heat and the dust and the brutal sun followed us into the house, leaning through the open doors and windows, trying to penetrate the cool darkness. William stood and clapped his hands. He beamed at Marty and I and said, "Do you want to watch a movie?" I said yes, thinking that I needed a break from my dark thoughts. William helped himself to the portable DVD player in a cabinet. He flipped through some burnt DVDs. As he did, children who had been staring at us through the open windows wandered into the house. The DVD played, and while I was expecting an overdubbed version of Bridget Jones' Diary or something, what I saw on the screen was an amateur video shot from behind a bush. It showed young men in army fatigues ducking and shooting machine guns through dense green foliage at an unseen enemy. They spoke to each other in their native tongue, yelling frantically at times, and then nothing but the sound of gunshots and distant explosions as they exchanged fire. The blood drained from my face. William looked at me and asked, "Do you hear that boom?" I nodded with an open mouth. "Those are RPGs." He announced this proudly, grinning so wide that his cheeks might crack. I leaned back in my seat and lit another cigarette as the children crowded around the screen. William scolded them for blocking my view, but I was looking out the window. The rest of the trek was unremarkable, but I spent the whole time looking over my shoulder like a kid checking under the bed for boogeymen. By the time I was back in my hotel room in Sipah, I was ready to go back to something familiar. I was shaken by this brush with war. I went online and booked a ticket for a flight back to Bangkok. The next morning, we said our goodbyes. Marty left Sipah the same way he came, on a rented motorcycle. William stayed in Sipah, ready to take another group of trekkers out of the city and up into the mountains. And I got on a train, headed back to Mandalay to catch my flight. As the mountains disappeared behind me, I thought about William and those soldiers. On the very last day of our trek, when we had arrived back in the city and were drinking cold mango juice, I felt relaxed for the first time in days. I asked William if he was surprised when we saw the soldiers. He said no. He saw them often, and it was nothing special. I showed him a map of the region and asked him to show me where we had walked. He traced the route with his thumb, from Sipah up into the mountains and then back again. Then I asked him where the fighting was. He furrowed his brow at the map, decoding the mountains. He pointed to a spot south of Namshan, a short distance from the paths we had been walking on, maybe 30 miles. And one last time, he explained to me, "You see? Very far. Very far." I went to Myanmar to experience something foreign, and I succeeded. But what was most foreign wasn't the food or the terrain or even the soldiers. It was living for a few days in a world where 30 miles is very far and where war isn't close until you can smell it.
Bridget Burnquist produced this episode of Here Be Monsters. Bridget is a writer and radio producer living and working all over the world. You might remember early in this episode when Bridget mentions getting robbed during her travels. She told that story in an earlier episode of Here Be Monsters, way back in season 1. It's episode 13. It's called Bridget Finds Loss. More of her work is at bridgetburnquist.com. As of May 2015, William is still guiding treks in the Shan state of Myanmar. Since the conflict in Myanmar began, it's estimated that 130,000 civilians and soldiers have been killed. Over 700 died this year. The most recent round of peace talks between the Burmese government and armed ethnic groups ended in a stalemate. There is a general election slated for November this year. Aung San Suu Kyi, a Burmese advocate for democracy, is attempting to run for president, but is currently disqualified. The situation is complex, so for this episode, Bridget compiled a small set of resources that help tell the story of Myanmar's political conflict. You can find links on our website, hbmpodcast.com. Also at our website, we have a bunch of really beautiful photographs from Bridget's trip to Myanmar, including lots of great images of William and the tea plantations, the mountain meals, and the terrain of the Palong region. Again, our website is hbmpodcast.com. The story was edited by Jeff Emptman and me, Bethany Denton. Nick White is our editor at KCRW. Music came from The Black Spot, Saracel, Nim, and Lucky Dragons. Here Be Monsters is a production of KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon.
Love you, bye!